So this morning, Kate and I will be sharing the talk, and Steve will be sharing the Dharma dialogue, responding with us. And since Kate and I both have had the opportunity to start, we metaphorically flipped a coin for it, which took the form of, no you, no you, no you, no you, no you. And so here we are, I'm starting. This is case 84 from the Blue Cliff Record. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is a bodhisattva's entry into the Dharma gate of not two? Manjushri said, according to what I think, in all things, no words, no speech, no demonstration, and no recognition to leave behind all questions and answers. This is entering the Dharma gate of not two. Then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, we have each already spoken. Now you tell us, what is a bodhisattva's entry into the Dharma gate of not two? And Shwedo comments, what did Vimalakirti say? He also said, I know all about that. And Shwedo also wrote a verse to accompany this koan, and I'm going to read that verse to you now. He says, bah to old Vimalakirti. Out of compassion for living beings, he suffers an empty affliction. Lying ill in Vyasali, his whole body withered and emaciated. Manjushri, the teacher of seven Buddhas, comes to the single room that's been swept repeatedly. He asks about the gate of not two, then Vimalakirti leans and falls. He doesn't lean and fall. The golden-haired lion has no place to look. So, some of you may have noticed last night before Mike's beautiful encouragement talk, a little bit of laughter or barely contained hilarity coming from this end of the zendo. And if you were far away, you might have wondered, now what? And now what was that Diane came up to me where I was sitting in my seat, and she stood in front of me, not saying anything, what I like to call the thundering silence of Diane. And I looked up at her and hoped she would bend down, as we do, and whisper something in my ear. But she just stood there, and she turned her raksu around. And I still didn't know what was going on, and I looked at her, and then I looked at the raksu, and the name on the raksu was Melissa. We had both hung up our raksus on the beautiful new raksu pegs outside the women's bathroom, and when I came out of the bathroom, I took the gold-colored raksu, the ochre-colored raksu. It seemed a little bit better fit than usual, but it wasn't much to remark upon. And later, when we were talking about this at the teachers' meeting, we did switch raksus at that point, and then started the laughter that you may have heard. In the teachers' meeting, James said, I wouldn't have given it back. I would have waited to see how long it would take Melissa to notice. And so we understand that we have many different personal styles. We have many different ways of encountering the great way. And James and Diane's demonstrations were just perfect, just the way they were. So this is what I wanted to talk about today, a little bit into the matter of something Alan raised yesterday about Vimalakirti feigning his illness. As it says in the Vimalakirti Sutra, he created his own illness in the translation by Robert Thurman that I read from a few days ago. And what does this mean to feign or create something that isn't here? Vimalakirti was renowned as a great master of the way, and as we've talked about, a couple of us have talked about, his capacity to enter into any situation fully. Whether it's a tavern or a brothel, whether it's the Buddha's group of disciples, whether it's the bodhisattvas coming to his small room to talk about non-duality, the Dharma gate of not two. He enters into everything fully. So what does it mean to feign illness? And what was it about his illness? Was he really sick, or was he just pretending? And all of the pieces of the koan that Shui Do collected and then Yuan Wu pulled up into this collection we call the Blue Cliff Record, with a bunch of comments and commentary by Yuan Wu, a teacher who lived a bit later at the end of the 11th, 12th century in China, than Shui Do. Shui Do and Yuan Wu don't mention that he pretended. Just like they don't, they added the line about, this is what I think. This is so important in the Zen way, to uniquely be ourselves completely. My thought is this. This is how I see it, Manjushri says, in our koan tradition. This is my understanding, my experience, my way of encountering the world. And so he also, Yuan Wu and Shui Do, they choose not to mention that he pretended, but instead that he took on the sickness of the world. He had entered so many other places of suffering to teach the Dharma. This was the one that was left to him. The great suffering that comes to all of us, actually, if we're lucky, because the thing that comes to all of us is death. But some of us live long enough to get sick. And that is the nature of human beings. Sometimes we get sick when we're little babies, and that becomes something that colors our lives forever. The experience of being unwell is something that can't be replicated. It can't be understood by the people who remain hale and hearty for a while. I guess there's some percentage of people who never get sick and then just die suddenly or die in their sleep. And that's great, you know, since we all have to go somehow. But most of us are exposed to pathogens and our immune system just can't handle them. We suffer accidents. We hurt ourselves in so many ways. We have heart attacks and fall off ski lifts. All these things happen to us as human beings. Yuan Wu does quote from the Vimalakirti Sutra at one point in his commentary about what Vimalakirti has to say about the body. And when I was reading the whole sutra last night, or parts of it, I still haven't read the whole thing through, but the parts that were about this part, I realized that what Yuan Wu chose to excerpt is directly related to our Zen practice. Because even in the Vimalakirti Sutra, there are paragraphs and paragraphs about how awful the body is. That it's just a wreck, and it's always falling apart. And so don't get lost in the body. Realize that there's this other thing that we call the body of the Tathagata, the body of thusness. And he says, realize that. But certainly, in my understanding, in Boundless Way Zen and in the way most of us teach, we value this human body as the only place where awakening can actually occur. We don't have to abandon the body to find some other place. We don't have to abandon our life to find the lotus land. We don't have to leave behind our family, our friends, our work, to realize the great way together. Instead, we find a way to integrate. And I'm thankful to Shui Do and Yuan Wu, who, even though they lived 1,000 years ago, their teaching is so close to our teaching, because they're saying more or less the same thing. It's right here, whether you're sick or well, whether you're pretending or whether you're actually sick, it doesn't make any difference, you're still sick. Vimalakirti says, in our tradition, the whole world is sick, and so I am sick. And this is what Yuan Wu quotes It's a comment on the line, "His whole body withered and emaciated," which I was interesting to see in the Cleary translation. Withered and emaciated is also a word for slender and beautiful, like a woman or a man who have really, you know, done a lot of dieting and exercise, and they're sort of willowy and appear in magazines. It has that flavor to it. So it's not a, "Oh man, withered and emaciated, how awful." It's just a statement of fact. Not much meat on the bones. That's it, right? And I just kept thinking about my own mother when she was dying of cancer. All her life, well, she was very thin when she married my father, when she was very young. And then she just started gaining weight, as some of us do. And she dieted and tried to, she exercised, she did everything she could do. She never could lose the extra weight that came on decade after decade. And when she was dying of cancer, she got out of her bed and took me to her closet. And she said, "I've been saving some of these clothes with the hope that I could fit into them someday. And guess what? Now I can fit into them." Isn't that great? She was quite a little spark of a person. So great, not great. She was dying. That's why she was so skinny. But it had been something she'd been longing for. Good, bad, I don't know. But she could fit into her old clothes, and for a few weeks that was a pleasure to her. And here is Vimalakirti, withered and emaciated, lying in his bed. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, which also isn't in the koan, he complains to the Buddha, and some of us know this complaint, "I'm so sick and nobody's coming to visit me. You don't write, you don't call." It doesn't say that literally. But he was not just withered and emaciated in the body, he was sick. He wasn't feeling well. He wanted to be visited. And so finally, you know, the Bodhisattvas came. So this is what Yuan Wu quotes from Vimalakirti. He says, "His whole body withered and emaciated. This body has no permanence, no strength, no power or solidity. It's a thing that quickly decays. It can't be trusted. It produces suffering and trouble, a mass of diseases. It is something made of the heaps, elements, and sense media compounded together. It can't be trusted." Well, I'm a child of the 50s and 60s, and I was taught in the waves of all kinds of therapies that came through at those times, trust your body, trust your emotions. And I tried, being a person who likes to follow other people who seem to know what they're talking about. And then I remember once hearing, and I've quoted this before, a line from Leonard Cohen from one of his songs saying, "I don't trust my inner feelings." I just thought, what? And the next line is, "Inner feelings come and go." I was talking to some friends of mine who I consult with regularly about my practice and my life. They're good friends. They live up in Canada. Their main work is to sit by the bedsides of people in comas and reassure the families of the people in comas and also the people who are in the comas themselves. They sit with a kind of sense of connection to everyone. And I was complaining to them how unreliable my body was, because as I'm getting older, I'm having all kinds of things happen, and some of you know what this feels like. And it's frustrating. I want to be able to wake up in the morning and trust that everything's going to work. And it doesn't work. I mean, in so many ways, I'm just not going to get into the details. You could actually read the Vimalakirti Sutra and see some examples of the ways the body fails us. And so I was saying, it's unreliable. And they said, "But you're so reliable." And it was one of those moments where I said, "I don't think I want to be reliable anymore. I don't want to be responsible anymore. I want to just be able to live each moment as it unfolds, allowing the Dharma to come through as it comes. Clumsily, wisely, compassionately, cruelly, it doesn't matter. the Dharma will come through, and I don't have to make it happen. I just have to get out of my own way. Does it matter what name is on my raksu? I don't think so. But it was nice to have my old raksu back. It was nice to have the sense of the Melissa that I've created over 63 years of really hard work. The Melissa that is constantly coming and going, that has no solidity and no reliability. And of course, what came to mind was the old song that some of you might know, "Call me irresponsible. Call me unreliable. Throw in undependable too." And this song, if you haven't heard it before, dissolves into what I think is underneath all of these teachings. Of Vimalakirti lying in his bed of suffering, withered and emaciated, looking like a fashion model. Who knows? Underneath all of this, in the song, it says, "All I want is to love you." That's it. And that's what needs to motivate us. A love for this life. A love for the Dharma. And a love for the great luck that allowed us to encounter these teachings.
Melissa started right out pointing in the direction that I wanted to talk about, this place of playfulness, of uncertainty. Someone standing in front of you and showing their raksu, and you don't, oh, sorry, and you don't know why. This is the place that we seem to arrive at by day four of Sesshin, where the rules fall away, where the boundaries and borders seem not to be where we had last left them, and where we begin to forget what we're supposed to be doing during ceremonies, or should we bow or should we sit, and how do we play our instruments, and all of this, it just begins to crumble. And this is the mind, for me anyway, turning off the rational, not intentionally, but just falling into disuse, this rational rule-following mind, in favor of this internal landscape that we're spending so much time with now. I noticed one effect of this when we did the long kinhin outside yesterday or 2 days ago, I forget when it was, because that was forever. We were all filing out, and I had this sudden thought that the fish were whispering among themselves, "Look, the humans are coming out of their cave. They're squealing. Let's watch." But they had to watch from underneath the shelf of rock so they wouldn't frighten us away. And they've been given stern instructions not to stick their fins into our space. So this way of turning things on their heads that happens not intentionally. I didn't think up that thought; it just came. And how it mirrors what's there's nothing not true about it. It mirrors how we might ordinarily think. There's something wonderful about this mirroring that allows us to meet the world that is. It's all the world that is, but we meet it in a different way. We see it through fresh eyes and see other possibilities. And this is what I hear in this koan, well, actually in many koans. Koans take us to this place, it's like the express train. Ask us to set aside what we know as yes and no, as gain and loss, to loosen up those borders and rules that we've mapped out, and visit our world from another way of perceiving it. And we all have this facility, this faculty, this ability to perceive in different ways. But it's the one way has fallen into disuse. Our normal analytical thinking way works so well for us. Everything is structured around it. It's given value and gets us the things that we think we want. And so it sort of blots out everything else. But always there's something else functioning, whether we notice it or not. And so this koan points to that. So we have here also mirrored reality. So there's Manjushri and there's Vimalakirti. And Manjushri is from this intuitive world, this world of wisdom, which is this world, not different, but perceived a little differently. And Vimalakirti is the world that we know, the one that crumbles, the one that is painful and that must follow the rules of birth and death. And so they're speaking to each other. They are going back and forth. And interestingly, Manjushri, from this world that has no borders, from this place that we are touching that is wide open, chooses to expound using words, using the tools that we ordinarily would use in our rational, analytical, ordinary life. But their source is from this the depths of wisdom. And so they bring that with them. The words themselves being it, even without meaning. And on the other hand, there's Vimalakirti, who is in this crumbling world and crumbling himself along with it, and we with him. And he speaks without words. Thundering silence. And I love how there are these twists and turns, how they move back and forth between them from one world to another, just as we can. I remembered a time when I was 18, and my boyfriend of the time, who would one day become my first husband, he and I did a road trip across country. First time I'd ever been out west. And we drove and drove and drove and, you know, did the, got to about, I don't know, whatever's in the middle there, Kansas, all the flat states, the flat square ones. And it became night, and we decided that we would just take shifts driving through, that we didn't really want to see anything until we got to farther west. And we didn't care about what was in between. And so I drove for a while, and then I slept, and my boyfriend drove. And when I woke up, he said that we had arrived at Rocky Mountain National Park, I think it was, Estes Park. And it was pitch black. I couldn't see anything, but he said, this is where we're going to sleep. And we opened up the car doors, and we tumbled onto the grass on the side of the road. I don't even remember if it was actually a campground or not. I don't have a clue. But we slept there. And the next morning, daylight broke. I woke up. I sat up and opened my eyes. And there in front of me, for the first time in my sight, the Rocky Mountains, such as I could not have imagined, anything that huge. And I had this distinct impression that the mountain was making a sound. I still remember it. It gives me goosebumps to think about it. That somehow this sound was being received. And it wasn't a sound such as you hear with your ears. It was a sound such as is heard with the whole body. And not just this body that is Kate, but the body that is the universe. The Dharma body of the self speaking, and the Dharma body of the self listening. I had never sat a minute of Zazen up to that point, and it would be a while before I did. But that capacity to receive was there. The astonishment of seeing this great mountain, so great that everything was wiped away, and there was room for this to arise, to meet it in some other way. And I suspect that we all have these moments, and maybe we notice them, and maybe we don't, but that these are not things that can easily be spoken of. We set them aside as maybe not real, or a moment of dream, or I don't know what. It's dismissed. But we have that faculty, that ability to meet our world in this way. So Vimalakirti and Manjushri are conversing back and forth. And I especially appreciate that Vimalakirti is asking about this gate to non-duality. Just as we ask, what is this? What's going on? What is the sound of that mountain? How can it be? What happened to those boundaries I came in with, and borders and rules and the ways that I understood? And he questions and questions, gives everything that comes before him a chance to answer, just as we do as we sit. Whatever comes before us, we ask, what is this? What is this? And finally, Manjushri turns it around, another turn, these twists and turns, so wonderful, and asks Vimalakirti, what is it? And he answers from this place of the Dharma body of the universe. So in the verse, the teacher of the seven Buddhas comes. The room is cleared of everything. You ask for the gate to the one and only. The room is cleared of everything. Do we imagine that we must clear it? That there's something that must be gotten rid of? Here we are opening the doors and windows so that everything can flow freely. What needs to be swept away? The dust motes float through, and they sparkle in the sun, each one as it comes and settles away again. Nothing needing to be done. And yet, in the story, this room is cleared so that everything can enter, and it comes rushing in again, all the bodhisattvas. And then the question is, what is this? What is this? The questioning of each bodhisattva as it comes. And the question being, what is the gate to non-duality? What is the route to a room swept clean? And round it goes, sweeping it clean, everything rushing in, the twists and turns, nowhere to settle in, no yes or no, right or wrong, but only this constant flow pointed to by Vimalakirti and Manjushri. There is nothing right that can truly be called right. There is no wrong that can truly be called wrong. With right and wrong eliminated, gains and losses are forgotten. It is all naked and exposed. Thank you. also time for you all to weigh in and bring forth how it looks to you. Yes.
I've been sitting with this question of sickness and illness for a long time, and so it's so interesting that these talks are focused on it. Very confusing for me. How to identify it? What causes it? What cures it? Even what could there be benefits? And much of my childhood, my mother was sick, and I didn't understand why, and she would come up with all these reasons. Sometimes she would make up illnesses, and as an adult, I learned that it was often related to the substances that she was withdrawing from and could no longer obtain for one reason or another. And so confusing, I just didn't understand. And there were times where she would tell me that I was sick, that she would say, "You're not going to school today, you're sick." And it was partially for her to have our attendance records, my sister and I, show that we were absent a lot because we were sick, because she had a lawsuit. And I didn't understand. How do I tell if I'm sick? How do I know? How do I know? What do I need? How do I know what other people need? And funnily enough, so then I go into this field myself. And I was confused. She would go to doctors and she wouldn't get better. And so then I go into this field myself and I study what is sickness, what is, And Ed's comment yesterday just really sent me for a loop. I had never thought of her as a bodhisattva either. And the benefit of her sickness meant that my sister and I had so much uninterrupted time. We played together. We had all these universes. We became the best of friends. With no supervision. My mother told us one point, you guys raised me, but you left before I was done because my father got custody of us. So confusing. What is sickness? What is health? Is it all bad? Is it all bad? It's not all bad.
Jess, I think you're pointing to something that really we've all been touching on this week. It's so important to see that everything that arises is uninflected, and then we inflect it. Even sickness, even pain, terrible pain, or this kind of complete confusion about what's real that you had to find your way through to be able to be a functional grown-up human being. Congratulations, really. This is something I heard in Steve's talk the other night, and maybe Steve can speak to this, but that you can't leave the fact of pain arising, emotional, the situational or the physical, right, or the cognitive, might as well include them all. But what you can do is, I think what I try to practice is seeing it uninflected and seeing what else is present while the suffering is arising. Right? And that's what you did that naturally as a child, which may have been one of the things that saved you.
So, sickness has such a large impact on our lives, right? And sometimes I feel like I need to find some reason that things happen the way that they happen. And so I actually find that to be quite a painful thing. Right, to have to look for benefits. And of course there are consequences that we can point to that are not negative, that could be beautiful, right? But I would hate to think that the sickness and whatever problems and mistreatments and difficulties were in order for this other thing to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. That for me, I don't think that people deserve, you know, to be sick, or you know, that you have to earn your way out of some particular karma, or life is terribly unfair, you know, and all of us suffer greatly, and some much more greatly than others, you know. Terrible things happen to young babies, and it's hard to see how truly lucky we are that, you know, don't have those sorts of things happen. We all have plus and minus and agony and joy and hard to ever know, you know, what's the storyline here, you know. Maybe none.
And I think that the key word in what you're saying that's so important is the two key words I'm hearing. This is a very subtle point, right? Benefits and storyline. Right? Some causative factor leading to something. I was looking at a book last night hoping it would give me some material for the talk. It didn't. but it was by Brother Lawrence, who was a 17th century wonderful Christian teacher, and his view was that God gives us afflictions in order to teach us lessons. And I thought, there it is. That's where Western culture goes off base, right? That's where the storyline comes in. And it's so pervasive now in the modern age. You see it all the time. You know, a friend of mine had cancer. Was starting to get worse, and she was at a retreat at the time. I've told this story before, and she had to leave. And somebody said, "Do you think you weren't meditating right?"
Oh my God.
You know, so this is the kind of thing that we have to be so careful about attributing causation to. But there is causation. It's just every single thing that's ever happened is causing this thing to happen. It's not, and we pluck a few things and make up a narrative that, as Steve said, it's that hurts more than the sickness itself. So the subtlety of this too is that, and when we're sick, there's many other things also happening. You know, so it's hard to pin it down. Although, when we're in really great pain, sometimes that's just all absorbing. Yeah. So you can feel the subtlety of these things and the warning, I think, that we're both giving in different ways. Don't make something up. Alan?
So this is just this point out that we don't have Vimalakirti's miraculous powers to make us all fit by five.
There's still room up here.
I mean, we have that air conditioner back here. And I've never had trouble hearing from back here before. So something happened today that you know, I guess there's a mood of quietness, but I think it's hard for everyone that's behind this wall.
Okay.
Thank you.
We maybe don't have the conduits for sound. You know, there's people.
Yeah. They're being absorbed by people. Well, and I do see some spots around here, so I really encourage you to move forward.
We're shy.
Yeah. So yeah. Then take responsibility. Right? It's really fine. We can sit on our laps. We don't care. Did you hear that? Yes, you can sit on my lap. What are you saying? I'm slender and
emaciated. Come on,
yeah. Come all the way up. There's room here. There's room here.
Okay.
Yeah. And Alan, too. And Willie, even.
Wayne, did you have your...
Oh, it was just something I was thinking of yesterday, that the problem is wellness.
Wow.
In the sense, well, some years ago I was dating someone, and I was the discovering that there were no gaps with this person. There was nothing. We would say that there's no emptiness anywhere. Everything was tightly maintained, controlled, in a very soft, subtle way that you at first don't notice, and you begin to notice. And it finally clicked for me how this would never work when he said, I keep a revolver, and he named the particular type of weapon. It was something unusual and exotic. So that, you know, the day when I realize that there's no point in going any further because of the pain that I'll be experiencing. And he's speaking of illness and aging because he was much older. I'll just call you and let you know that I'm about to do this. And I thought, that's the final capping point of this control. It's like nothing ambiguous can be allowed to happen. And at the time I thought, how do you touch that? And calamity has to set in, you know. I didn't go far enough with this person to find out if there were any little, you know, fissures where something could enter in or something in past experience. But the thought occurred to me, there are people going around with everything that they need. And everything can be so carefully arranged that they do not ever experience what we're talking about in terms of sickness. What could be more horrible than sickness, and that would be the wellness.
That's a wonderful example of that reversing, seeing things in mirror.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, what if he calls me someday? Perhaps because no one else has entered his life, if he just calls me and says, well, today's the day.
Oh.
And I could understand the impulse to do that, to arrange that. I can completely understand it, but from our perspective, we're so blessed and don't realize it because we're, in spite of resistance, we want to give ourselves to old age and death because we say this all the time. We don't come to the point of saying, I'm going to give myself to that. But we say, I can't escape it. So we're strange creatures.
Well, and I think this is why we include that chant in the Five Remembrances in daily liturgy to remind ourselves that this is the case, because it is every instinct says to move away from it, right, to deny it. To act as though that won't happen, or to take control, and so we remind ourselves again and again.
That's the one point in the liturgy where if I'm, you know, just escaping through the sound and the wonderful, you know, depth of the voice, that rivets me out of that. Those just careful, simple little phrases. So everything else I can just let go of. That comes home.
Thank you. Steve?
Yeah, to follow up a little bit on what Josh said, in my experience, in my view, okay, this experience of non-duality or non-separation comes to me through grief, because there's this sudden visceral experience about realizing that there was this connection, still is connected, and it's very deep, and it's not it's on a level of like tissue level, if you know. So, the one example I would have, it's a very, it's not like Ed's deeply felt expression about his father, but it was about a dog. Just, you know, a mutt that I had, okay? And So the day came when we had to put Emma down, you know, when I took her to the vet. I couldn't be in the room with her. Sometimes I feel like, you know, I'm feeling alone, or maybe, you know, this separateness that sometimes we feel. I just think, you're not separate. You are deeply, deeply connected.
Thank you, Steve. Jenny?
We've been doing Om Nam every day. That it brings up a story for me, and that's one of the ways the universe responds. And I'm always, not always, but I was thinking about that story, which I'm not going to tell you, but just, you know, where does that story start? And where does it end? If I did want to tell that story, how would I tell that story? And I was thinking about how it's a bunch of threads, and it doesn't begin at a birth, and it doesn't end at a death. And it's a bunch of threads all tangled up, and I pick out this one and that one.
That's totally it. We're all laughing because that's exactly what Zen exposes for us, the story-making apparatus. We were realizing one day, I remember David and I were visiting my brother, that human beings can take two things that are completely separate and put them together and make up a story about them. You know, and there's 8 billion things are happening in each moment, and we can only perceive 8 of them. So we pick the ones that are our favorites. Usually they're the ones that are most familiar. Then we string them together, make a story, and we remember it. And then it's a story about ourselves, or it could be a story about the world. But you just had to realize the strand-like nature and the way we weave these things together. That's powerful. I don't think we can stop making up stories. We're story-making animals. But we can see the stories, and we can see the ones that really hurt us, you know, maybe, and just have a little bit of, well, and that goes back to Kate's point, you know, there are times in this practice when the capacity to make up these stories starts to decay, because we're tired and our brains are, you know, I love Sashin at this point on some level, right, because it's like, I can't keep it going. And so it's not that we, and this is another one of those subtle points, we don't let go of things or stop things or make things different. We see and are awake to the functioning of the body-mind, and we get smarter and smarter about it, and it decays on its own, because everything decays. Everything comes and goes. So our job is only to pay attention in a sometimes a sorrowful way, sometimes an amused way, sometimes an agonized way, sometimes, you know, it's our next time. Thank you, John.
I'm sorry.
We'll do Julie first, and then
on this story making brought up. There's a game called PowerPoint Karaoke. Somebody downloads a bunch of random slides from the web, puts them in any order, puts them on a screen, and people have to get up and make up. Then PowerPoint Karaoke night sometime.
Let's do that.
The other thing that I've been noticing arising is a certain amount of contrariness coming up. When Wayne was talking, I can see the over-control about wanting to get that last moment. And also, as I'm thinking about the amount of money our healthcare system spends on the last few months of life, I don't want to go there. I do not intend to do that at the end. I will do other things. rather, and you know, is that controlling? There's two sides to that. And then you were talking about the body being unreliable. We're talking a lot about sickness, but I have to say that besides sickness, the other place where that has shown up very often in my life is sexual attraction. Mm-hmm. Totally unreliable.
Amen.
And at the same time, it's very important to pay attention to these. It's information.
It's information.
That all of this information. And I've been dealing with some health issues lately, and I notice a lot of it has to do with some fatigue that just kind of comes and goes. And sometimes I don't notice it until I realize I've got my head down on the sink, and I think, oh, I should take this as a piece of information. I'm feeling fatigued right now. But yeah, anger, illness, the rest of this, it's information. It's important to pay attention to, even though it's not reliable in the way that we want it to be.
Well, it's the subtle, it's another subtle point, right? It's not reliable. Because what's not reliable is the story making.
The story making and the acting
on it automatically happens. Yeah. There must be something wrong with me. There's, you know, instead of just feeling fatigue and then letting that, pausing with it long enough to give you a way through to the next moment. Thank you.
I just sort of wanted to pick up on what Jenny was saying about these sort of endless threads that weave together in all directions. And sort of, again, in my experience, that all the sickness and pain and what often seems like chaos in our lives, ultimately, it's not random. I mean, there is at the bottom of the bottom some glue that there's order in the universe that's holding things together. And I think, you know, sometimes we can see that, get far enough away from something to see how it unfolds in a way that makes sense to us. Sometimes we never will. But still there's this deep, deep kind of sense of, or knowing that there is order that's holding it all together.
I guess I see that, yes. And it's so easy to slide that into everything will be okay. You know, and you were pointing out we often can't get a big enough picture to see what that is. But just to state it out loud that order can include some chaos, right?
We may destroy this planet we live on, but you know the universe will go on.
And
so sometimes it's on a scale that's much beyond what we can appreciate in our moment-to-moment life, but that the universe will continue in some way.
Well, you know, it's so great. I love that you started with, in my opinion, in my experience, there's two koans that we work with in our koan tradition. And one of them, the first one that comes, is in the Gateless Gate. And somebody asked the teacher, when everything is destroyed, will it be destroyed? And the teacher says, no, it will continue. You know, like the Dharma can't be destroyed. And then there's a koan later, when everything is destroyed, will it be destroyed? And the teacher says, yes. Yes, it will. Everything will go. It also, this whole thing reminds me of the television show The Good Wife. If any of you have ever watched that, there's a series of judges that keep appearing in, as characters, and they're all really nuts. And I've known a few judges, and it seems fairly accurate to me. Once you get into power, there's some evidence that power gives you brain damage, that you can no longer have the mirror neurons stop working. You don't take as much input in from the outer world. And all these judges are like this. And there's one judge in particular who won't let any of the lawyers in the courtroom say anything unless they start by saying, in my opinion. And she'll interrupt them and she'll say, how do you know that? Isn't that your opinion? And they always go, yes. And of course the better lawyers get it. And they say, judge, in my opinion, with a big smile. And they're the ones who win the cases. So it is very important that everything is a view. Whether there's glue that holds the universe together or not, whether we're going to blow the planet up or not, it's still one of these strands that we're pulling together to make into a story. And, you know, we have to make these stories up. And then we also have to be willing to let them burst into a zillion pieces right in front of our faces. That sounds terrible, but it's actually quite liberating in my experience and in my opinion. So, I'm very grateful. Thank you. Mm-hmm.